Ready? Okay, cool.
Hello, and welcome to Practical Internet Security. My name is John Pierce, and I'll be your guide for this next hour or hour and a half or so. First off, I got some bad news for you. There's no security silver bullet. There's no one product that I can recommend that will guarantee that your system will never be hacked. If there was, I'd put a link to it up there and go hit the console.
Power switch.
Now, security is actually more of like a cat and mouse game. You know, if you're sitting on these panels, you're probably going to hear this reoccurring theme that attackers come up with tools, defenders come up with countermeasures, attackers come up with more tools, so on. And it keeps going. So you might be asking yourself, well, if somebody's going to be able to hack my system no matter what I do, why should I bother, right? Well, it's kind of like cars, too. Auto security has advanced a lot over the last couple years. I mean, you got locks now, you got alarm systems, computer-controlled ignition kill switches, the club, blowjack, all that stuff. And you think, well, with all that stuff, certainly no luxury cars ever get stolen, right? Now, the reality is there's always going to be people out there with the proper motivation, patience, and skill set to overcome any security. I mean, this is true if we're talking about hacking a machine or whether we're talking about stealing the car. The goal in security is always to raise the bar, though. I mean, your average car thief is not going to be able to circumvent an alarm system. They're not going to have laser-cut keys. They're not going to have the microchips required. They're not going to know where LoJack is and how to remove it. Your average car thief usually picks targets of opportunity, you know, where people left themselves wide open. I mean, you think about it. Car thief walks into a parking lot. There's two cars, a Jaguar, security to the nines, and a Honda with the windows rolled down, the doors unlocked, and the ignition key sitting there right in the driver's side seat. Which one do you think he's going for? My money's on the Honda. Why? Because it's an easy score. You know, there's absolutely no risk right off the bat. They sit in, they drive away. Anybody seeing them? Looks like they're just driving away a car. And there's so many Hondas on the road that the chances of the cops being able to find them when they're using it is really low. Well, it's the same thing with your system. You know, while there may be more bandwidth and better machines and better networks that are owned by corporations, your machine is less likely to be defended. Therefore, it becomes more valuable. A lot of people say, you know, well, why me? Why would anybody want to single out me? What do I have? Why is my machine so important? Skipped one. Yeah, there we go. Why me? First off, random acts of vandalism. Viruses, worms, people who just either want to make a political statement or just wreak some havoc. Why? Because it makes them look good to their friends. You know, they can go, hi, you hear about that Anna Kournikova virus? I wrote that. You hear about CERCAM? That was mine. You know, I mean, look good to their friends and get all kinds of praise. Bandwidth. Bandwidth is valuable. I mean, you may think, well, okay, what is my... even if you don't have broadband, you're thinking, okay, I got a 56K, right? If somebody wants to take down a machine and use it, they're going to go after somebody with a cable modem, they're going to go after DSL, they're going to go after a corporation. Well, the truth is, it starts to add up. You know, yeah, I can go hit a corporation, but it's going to be hard to get in there. They're probably going to have firewalls, they might have security professionals, they're going to have intrusion detection. Home users, especially those on 56Ks, usually don't worry about it. I can send out an email, and then all of a sudden, within a day or so, I've got hundreds of machines reporting back to me that they've been infected and are ready for my use. So I accomplish the same goal, get the same amount of bandwidth, except these people, A, you know, were left unprotected, so it was easy to get their machines, and B, they're not likely to know what to look for. They don't know that their machine's been compromised, and until it's actively being used, they may have no indication whatsoever that I own it. So I can use hundreds and hundreds of dial-up machines or combination of dial-up and broadband, cable modem, DSL, and do things like distributed denial of service and bring the most mighty companies that pay for huge OC-12s, you know, multiple pipes, bring them down to their knees just by compromising enough 56K dial-up modems. Actually, some friends of mine at work did some calculations, and we figured with a couple hundred dial-up modems, even if everybody wasn't getting the best connection speeds, you could bring down just about anybody in the world. You know, it's pretty impressive, especially when it can all be automated and it requires very little work on the end of the person who's trying to initiate all of this. So bandwidth is a concern. Covering their tracks, same kind of thing. I mean, we live in an age where you probably heard a lot about spoofing. If you listen to anything about security, you heard about spoofing attacks, things like that, where you hide your IP address when you're doing things. That works great for when we're talking about SYN floods, ping floods, stuff like that, because all you're doing is tossing a bunch of packets downline, and you don't have to ever get any responses back, so it doesn't matter where you say you're coming from. It's like sending letters out to somebody with forged address. You know, great, the letter's going to get there, and they won't know where it came from. But unfortunately, if you want to do anything that's TCP related that requires a handshake, you actually have to exchange destination. Just like if you actually want to exchange correspondence, that letter's got to be able to get back to you. If they can't write back to you, then what use is it? So then the attackers go, well, so if I've got to have a TCP, if I've got to have a box and that box has to establish a connection, why should it be mine? Why should it be traced back to me? So better yet, compromise somebody else's machine, use their machines for all of these attacks that require a handshake, then remove your tools as you exit out. If anybody's going to look guilty, it's going to be them, not you, right? And even if not, it'll take the top cops long enough to try to track down and find out where it really came from that you could be long gone before they ever got there. So there's plenty of reason to worry as a home user. What can they do to you, you know? What are the headaches? Because, yeah, they can get my machine, but what's it really going to cost me, you know? Well, loss of data. A lot of these things, especially like you're talking about CIRCAM, has a random chance of destroying your hard drive. Not permanently, but wiping all the data that's on there. So, you know, all your emails and all the projects you've been working on, documents, whatever, gone. Plus you have the time and hassle of doing OS reinstall, which is never fun. Eats a couple hours out of your life. Loss of resources. The more stuff that's running on your computer, the slower it's going to run. I mean, there's only so many CPU cycles and so much memory that your machine has. The more of these things that they put on, you know, the slower it's going to get. Embarrassment. It's funny. My mom came to me last week. She was all worried about antivirus. And I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "Well, a friend of mine just sent me an email saying that she wanted everybody to take her off of their contact list, or at the very minimum get antivirus, because she'd been hit by 4 viruses in the last 2 months. Now, luckily, my mom wasn't the one that had sent any of these viruses to her, but it still brings up the point. You know, I mean, if something an email attachment comes in and either you open it up or Outlook opens it up automatically for you, because surely that's what you want to do, suddenly everybody in your contact list is getting infected by your machine. And of course, you know, they're probably not going to be too happy about that. So, you know, a little loss of face. The most serious thing and the greatest cause of concern, though, is legal troubles. Imagine this scenario. You're at work. It's about, you know, 2:00 in the afternoon, hard work at your desk. All of a sudden, your boss leads 2 FBI and 4 state police over to your desk. They snap handcuffs on you, take you down to the station. Meanwhile, your house is being entered with a search warrant. Your machine is being seized, and your house is being turned upside down. The reason? Because you're running a kiddie porn server from your home computer. Now, of course, you have no knowledge of this, and you're like, what are you talking about? But the reality is they can come back to you and say, look, this evidence is all over your hard drive. Now you're stuck in the awful position of trying to prove that you're not guilty. Because as I said, the evidence is all over your hard drive. Somebody could have compromised your box, because of course they're not going to want to run a kiddie porn server from their box, because anybody who can find that stuff can be FBI, can be looking for them. So they come, and again, goes back to hiding where you're coming from. They come looking for you and not the person who really placed that stuff on your machine, not the person whose intent it was to distribute. You're still caught in the ugly battle, and while you're trying to work it out, you're losing a lot of money to legal fees and losing a little bit of reputation, and your machine is impounded. You know, not necessarily a good thing. And even if it wasn't something as severe as kiddie porn, you know, we just had a panel right before, or just had a discussion right before here on Napster. Well, peer-to-peer stuff too. It might be the copyright Gestapo comes down. Maybe all of a sudden you start getting threatening letters from your ISP because you are infringing on certain of the RIAA's artists' rights by offering content up for, you know, Amster, Kazaa, any of these other things. And you're completely unaware of it. You're like, well, news to me, but they've threatened to shut your service off. Again, same kind of problems. How do they get in? Oh, yes?
Immediately. Otherwise, they risk being sued themselves.
Well, it goes back and forth. Congress was nice enough to insulate the ISPs a while back against the content of their against infractions by people who they provide services to. It legally, they're obligated, if there's infringing or illegal content and you approach them and you tell them about it, then they have to deal with it. They can't just say, you know, go take a hike. But usually it involves sending out a letter that says cease to desist, you're in violation of your terms of agreement. If you don't do the terms, then we'll cut it off. But you're right, sometimes they do just cut it off. It's up to the individual ISPs. Yes?
I'm from Greenville. I'm a network administrator of a small commercial printing company. We run a lot of other internet services out of our network ops center.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, what they do is they'll lean on the network provider. Basically, they'll lean on me if somebody that's on my network is doing something like this, and which will then, you know, having that hot plate burning under your butt, you'll go after trying to find out who's doing it. And usually your ISP will be, they'll put pressure on your upstream ISP, and they will send you that threatening letter. It's usually the way it works. I've never known anybody who has just gotten cut like that.
Yeah, it gets down into that gray area, because since they have some insulation, whoever is saying that you have infringing material, whether it be copyright, whether it be, you know, something that's just flat out illegal, the ISPs tend to handle it differently. I mean, you could just be cut off, but you're right. You generally would get warning ahead of time. But the FBI is going to do no such thing. If they find something like, if they find child pornography, they're going to arrest you. They're going to seize all your stuff, and then you're going to have a hard, long, hard fight ahead of you proving that you're not a pedophile. Yeah, exactly. Well, how do they get in? Well, I mean, they get in any network-aware application. I mean, here's some common ones up here. Email attachments. Email attachments are pretty bad. Yeah, that's probably the single worst source of infection for viruses, and it's also getting pretty bad for backdoors, for Trojans. People send you things that say that they're one thing, and you go to execute them, and it turns out, no, indeed, they're quite something else. Web and FTP sites can be bad for again, Trojans, things that are labeled as one program when in reality there's something totally else. But also, websites can have malicious ActiveX payloads. I mean, it's possible that you could just go to a website, and just by the act of going to the website, if you have everything installed default, all of a sudden some very nasty things can be installed on your machine without you ever even noticing. You never clicked a button that said, okay, I want to download this. It just happens. Yes, in the back.
Are there any, can you just open the message like in Netscape, it's where the text says, here's something great, click on the attachment. Is there any danger in, can they embed anything in the text of the message, or is it just the attachment that's the danger?
If it's HTML or rich text, it's possible, but it's not as bad as HTML. You can embed all kinds of, it's the same thing as surfing to a page. Because what they can do is if you have an HTML and it renders in your email, it's the same thing as your browser going to a page and those ActiveX controls that I was talking about. JavaScripts, but to a less extent, because JavaScripts are generally used more of an annoyance as anything else. Because of the architecture of Java, you've got something called a sandbox, which actually is an interpreted language. You can set what calls it can actually make in your operating system, and you can set varying levels of safety in there. And so, you know, through that abstraction layer, you've got some protection. Most things you'll see JavaScript for is if you go to like a site, automatic pop-ups that you don't initiate. What a lot of people like to call a porn storm. You know, you go to one site, and then all of a sudden hundreds and hundreds of websites are opening up all the time, and you can't shut them down fast enough. That's a good abuse of JavaScript. But as far as access that it has to your actual machine, not nearly as dangerous as ActiveX. ActiveX, you know, I don't want to pick on any Redmond-based companies or anything, but you gotta see them. When different companies make commercial software, they generally sell you upgrades. You know, they want to sell iterative versions of the product. Now, oftentimes, you know, you release a product, you find out that there's a lot of bugs in it, and you fix it. But people would be rather upset if every 2 years you were charging them $300 to fix holes in their product. So what they do is they implement all these new features. They're bullet points for selling the product. You know, it now does this, and it does this, and it does this, and we've integrated here, and we've integrated there. Now, the reality is most people don't use any of these features, and the features are put in there solely as selling points to get you to buy it. Often, they even put the features in and they realize, you know, coming from a QA background, I can tell you that I have seen and heard a lot of this. Well, they'll put features in there that they know nobody's going to use, so they don't get tested all that well. You know, I mean, how many people are going to use the print straight from IIS, right? That dot printer thing? Well, Code Red, the IDA and dot printer overflows that allowed, like, Code Red to populate all over the internet. Nobody ever uses that, but it's turned on by default because they said, well, if we went to all the trouble to code this, of course you're going to want it to be turned on and be available for your use anytime you want. Yes?
All right. Also speaking about the email attachments, is Outlook the only one, or should I say the most popular email client that actually has that limitation, that fault, or should I say had that fault? I mean, Eudora, Netscape.
Well, we'll get more into when I start talking about locking down. We'll talk a little bit more about that. Outlook is the big vulnerability. Because of VBS scripting, because all of the Office suite allows scripts to move from one to the other, so from one application in the Office suite to another application, which is really bad because somebody may discover a hole in Access. You may never use Access, but when you did your install, it installed it on your machine. The problem is somebody can write a script that exploits a bug in Access, email it to you. When you auto preview or when you open that email, it'll launch that script, then go into Access, exploit the vulnerability, and do whatever it needed to do. So we're not even talking about bugs in Outlook. We're talking about bugs anywhere in the Office suite or in the operating system, which that's where it starts to get hairy. Plus, with the Microsoft operating systems having a monopoly in the home user market, and the Office suite pretty much having a monopoly in productivity software, people write for what's out there. So it's a combination of the two.
Sorry, just a clarification. Even if you don't have Access open and running at that point.
Correct. It just has to be installed. Now, if you didn't have Access installed, that VBS script may not work, but oftentimes people code specifically to Outlook holes. But anything in the Office suite, I mean, you can use macros too. Macros, a lot of the scripting stuff allows, certainly when you make a WordPerfect document, you want to be able to quickly integrate stuff from the database, and you want to do have an Excel spreadsheet in your Word document, all stuff. So they set up a scripting language that uses macros to embed things from certain objects from certain products into other products. Those macros can be exploited. You can actually download. A lot of people talk about dangerous things, file attachments. You always get EXEs, bad. Don't ever open them. VBS, also bad. Don't ever open it. But docs, WordPerfect documents, something.doc. A lot of people think that would be fairly innocuous, but you can embed some very nasty stuff in macros. Put it in a Word document. Somebody opens the document. They only see the text. The stuff, other stuff runs in the background. And, you know, you're rooted, and you didn't even know it. And that's pretty nasty.
Two things. Does that Access hole apply when you have Access on your computer and you have Outlook open and running or Outlook installed? Or if you don't have Outlook installed, does the Access and the other Office productivity suites still have holes that are accessible?
Well, see, and that's where it comes down. If you don't have Outlook installed and you're not using Outlook, that Access hole is still exploitable, but only if you choose to open up some malicious code that somebody's put embedded into an Access document. But it's the cross-scripting that becomes dangerous because Outlook is a great method of infection. Access is not, because generally, I mean, how often do you trade database files with people that you know? And you'd be suspicious if somebody sent you an Access database and said, here, open this, you know, I mean, you'd go, wait a minute, alarm bells start going off. But that same, but with the cross-scripting language, it allows for that same hole to be exploited just by you auto-previewing an email.
Second part of that, you mentioned ActiveX as problematic and JavaScript as maybe less so. I don't know if now is the time to ask or later, but are you going to make any distinction between Java, JavaScript, and those things, and what kinds of settings you know, the average user, the average conservative and circumspect and careful user should set things to?
Sure. Well, I'll get to that a little bit later. I just want to point out some of the stuff now and show where they're coming in. But I'll get to recommendations of how you can stop all this. He's fine. Yeah, there you go. Solidix, he's fine. Really, if you want to be hardcore, install OpenBSD, which is. Yeah, it's one of the few operating systems that was actually more or less designed from the ground up to be secure out of the box. It has everything turned off. Yeah, you want to go turn stuff on, and that too comes down on a scale. It's funny. On one end you've got security, and on the other end you've got usability. Now, you think if you're a program manager at a company and you're about to release your product, which end do you think to sell it? Do you want to put that product on? Usability. I mean, the problem is that most software, especially commercial software, free software not so much, because a lot of people say, well, you'll take the time to learn these things, and if you really want them, you'll go turn them on. But commercial software, it's about making the sale, and so they're going to turn everything on. And you just got to assume that when you get a new software package, it's like going to the dealership to pick up your car. You know, if it's got a sunroof, the sunroof's down. If it's got windows, the windows are down. It's unlocked, and they hand you the key. You know, it's the same way. And if you drive off the lot and then you just keep that security posture everywhere you go, you're in trouble. You know, I mean, they always fall back on, well, yes, but if everybody wanted to go search for the documents, we tell you how to turn all of this stuff off. And the reality is that most people don't see a need and don't understand the implications, so they never bother doing the research. They accept things default, as is, and that's what people count on when they make all this malicious code. They count on you doing a default install. And we'll talk about that later. That's you know, when you raise the bar on security by turning off a few of the default things, you suddenly make yourself a very unappealing target. Why am I going to waste time? If the default stuff doesn't work on you, why am I going to waste any of my time on your system when there's hundreds of thousands of other ones that I can go, you know, mess with and get in much easier? It's not worth the hassle. So by doing by taking a few steps and raising the bar a little bit, you can actually thwart a lot of these people who aren't going to waste their time with you. Yeah, they hide things. Some settings that they have. One gripe that I've always had with Microsoft is Microsoft operating systems can be secured. For the most part, they can. I mean, there's always they rusted out the door and left a bunch of bugs. But they're usually pretty good when they get told about applying patches. The problem is, in order to keep it secure, as soon as you get the machine, you have to spend a good amount of time turning stuff off. B, they put it in different places all over your machine, making it very hard for you to find what you need to turn on and off. And C, they release a bunch of security patches, but you know, you never hear about it. And if you're not thinking, it's the first of the month, I should probably go to Windows Update and see if I need to install the 10 security patches that have come out this month. You know, I mean, it ends up coming like that. Yeah, they're catching a lot of flack, and especially of late. So hopefully things will get a little bit better. Yes.
Going back to email attachments, are there files that are safe to open? I would think like pictures or text files, or
if they're really what you think they are. here's a big problem. The Anna Kournikova. If you had a default install of Office and Windows, when you got that Al-Qaeda virus, because that's what the media comes from, and it's the popular term, although it's really more of a worm than a virus. You get the attachment. The attachment said Anna Kournikova.jpg, right? The problem is the real extension was Anna Kournikova.jpg.vbs. And the reason you didn't see the VBS is because Microsoft decided in their infinite wisdom that users don't want to know what the extensions are on their files. You know, they really don't want to know. And they also don't want to see any hidden files. They don't want to see any operating system files. So what happens is you got, by default install, hide known file extension types. So since it hid the .vbs and it showed up as .jpg, you think, oh, it's a JPEG. Boom, you're hit. Yep.
And it's strictly stuff between character 32, between the two character and the
We've got an interesting thing that happened a couple months ago on Security Focus. They've come up with a way now using the class IDs. So even if you have showed known file types, what you have the ability to do is put going back to the Anacortic COVID. They didn't do it this way, but this is how it could be done now. You could put anacortic COVID.jpg. And then you'll see brackets and a whole bunch of numbers with dashes. And those are making reference to .vbs in the registry. So Microsoft automatically truncates those and hides all of them when you put them in the long format like that. And even if you have show known file types, you wouldn't see that. So you need to take care, even if it looks safe, you still need to take care. And we'll talk a little bit about that later, about some common sense stuff about how to prevent some of this. Quick, last two things on here, IRC. Oh, did I skip it? Okay, instant messaging clients. Instant messaging clients, they're way onto your machine. Normally, when you're sending messages, via AIM or ICQ or anything, you send a message to a server. Server sends a message to a person. Not that dangerous necessarily. Where it becomes bad is if you do a chat. If you open up a chat or you open up a file transfer, their machine connects directly to your machine, and now we've got issues. Other than that, the big problem is that people can send you web links that may have Unicode in them. And look like you may see, if somebody sends you a link and the link is full of just a whole bunch of stuff that has percents and capital letters and numbers and stuff like that in it, be wary. I mean, if it's somebody you know, maybe just talk to them back and say, what's it? Because there are some legitimate uses. People, if you see .asp at the end of it, a lot of it is options, things like that where it's a preset. If they sent you a link to an e-commerce shop, that all that stuff ahead of it might have told it, okay, you want this product to show it in this format. But you can abuse the hell out of web links and put in some Unicode, and it'll be doing things that you don't realize it's doing. Yes?
Actually, I got a two-part question. The first part of it is, now I know like with companies like Symantec and McAfee, they use like script blocking. Now, does that script blocking help out against any type of ActiveX attacks?
Is that what block? I couldn't hear you.
I was saying that I know programs like Norton AV and McAfee Shield use programs like script blocking. Now, does that help against any type of ActiveX attacks at all?
Yes, but it's signature-based, and we'll get to that a little bit later.
And I guess, my second part was is that now whenever you hear a virus coming out, say like the Red Code or CertCam, Code Red or CertCam, how fast do the companies like Symantec get out there and have some type of, patch there to fight against that? I mean, what is like the overlay time?
It depends. It depends on how complicated it was, how complicated the virus was. Keep in mind that a lot of these things are being generated by people using the automatic virus, automatic virus generation tools. You think I'm kidding, but I'm not. It says, okay, how many people do you want to affect? What is your message you want to do? Okay, and it spits you out a virus. And these people send them out. Those things take absolutely no effort whatsoever. The second they see the first one, if they don't have a signature that'll pick up stuff that the tool leaves, telltale markers that the tool leaves behind, then they'll have that thing, next day, and they'll probably have it out before you ever see it or hear about it on the news. But for some of them that are what I call more like, we got back to this, the professional car thieves that can bypass all the stuff. People who are professional black hats are people who are really good at writing viruses, and they come up with something unique. It depends on how long it takes for them to A, see it, and B, decompile it and come up with a signature that'll catch it. Turnaround time is usually pretty short, though, only a couple days, because if it has a high risk and it's likely to propagate very quickly, they'll work around the clock, sitting there trying to do it. Same kind of stuff that we do at ISS when we find new hacker tools and stuff like that. When they start going out in the public domain, we stay up, tear them apart, see what makes them work, see how we can find them, and then update our products as quick as possible. IRC is dangerous ground. Dangerous ground. I said it because a lot of people use it. It's a really cool thing. It allows you to talk to a lot of people, expand your social group. It takes for a lot of people who are like introverted, it allows them to go and have contact with people without any repercussions, without having to worry about, you know, maintaining relationships. You know, you can just shut the program down when you don't want to talk. But the other thing is, too, it's the prowling ground of the script kiddie. And if you're if you go to a lot of these panels and you go to all the hacking ones, you're going to hear that term a lot if you haven't already. And script kiddies are what we call people who don't themselves have the technological ability to write original exploits and to do original research and find vulnerabilities. But what they do know how to do is use a search engine. And they know how to use a search engine to find attack tools for new vulnerabilities that have just been released. And they know how to type in the name of the tool, and they know how to run it. And that's all they really need to know, you know, in some cases, to bring you down. And what we see a lot is people, you know, who are elite on IRC. And they do a lot of things that they want to impress their friends. So they want to impress their friends, and they also want to be able to attack and defend, because then that gives them an edge in the chat. So, like, if they think you're being annoying, then they'll wind nuke you and knock you off so your connection gets reset. Or if you really tick them off, then they may have a little zombie army, and they'll start pounding your connection until you either give or they think you've suffered enough, that kind of stuff. Bad thing about IRC, too, is it reveals where you're coming from. Unless you're using like a Wingate proxy, which most people aren't, and there are less and less open Wingate proxies these days, they're going to know your IP address. So if you tick them off, they know exactly where to find you. And also, you're interacting with a lot of people who may want to cause you harm. You know, viruses and email attachment things are indiscriminate. You know, they fly around hitting anybody. And there's a certain risk there and randomness. But you know, if you set up a few steps, you can prevent from being infected. But the motivation level is high. If you tick somebody off in IRC and they try to hit you and it doesn't work, they might keep going. You know, they might go get new tools and they might make a vendetta out of it, because there's no way that you're gonna escape. They have to prove that they have power over you, and until they can do that, they'll keep striving. So IRC is most dangerous for a motivation factor. Because I mean, it's kind of like breaking the law. You know, you can do things, you can speed all day long, and you know, speed for most of your life and never get caught. But you know, if there's a cop there with a gun, you're going down. You know, it's the same kind of thing with any illegal activity. Once you've popped up on somebody's radar, like the FBI, say you're stealing, selling cars, or selling drugs, or something like that, you may live your whole life and never do it. But the second the FBI gets wind of it, you're toast, because they'll watch you and they've got the time and the resources to make sure that they get you.
Now, there's a little catch on that. It also depends on the version of the or type of IRC daemon that your server is running. Some have a mode, I think it's mode plus X or something, which will automatically block your IP off and put guest.soandso.org.
But that gets overrun by a lot of places that require IDENT because there's still a record of it. So where it may hide you from standard queries, it still knows, the server still knows your IP address, and since the server still knows your IP address, somebody can get your IP address. So, and peer-to-peer is the newest little thing. If you guys were here for Napster right before here, we're talking about, you know, the court cases of bringing down Napster, and what they've done is, at least with Napster, there were centralized servers that kept track of who had what and what was going on, and as such, there was the potential to play some kind of security content filtering and make sure that certain kind of files didn't get on there. I mean, with Napster, only MP3s were available. People came out with tools that would encode things that weren't MP3s to look like MP3s, but it still was checking the byte stream to make sure, you know, not just the extension, it was checking the initial byte stream to make sure that it was really an MP3. Now with Kazaa and BearShare and Limelight, Namester, and like all these things, they're using something called Rumor, which basically means, like, I'll start up the program, I'll find one person that has it going, and I'll say, hey, who else do you know about? And it'll tell me who they know about. And I go talk to them and say, well, who else do you know about? And they'll tell me. So since there's no central servers, there's no threat of the RIA coming down. Of course, since there's no central servers, there's no protection for you other than the protection you take upon yourself. So that's another place to be careful, because you don't really know what you're getting. And so there's caution to be taken there, and we'll get more of that in a minute.
A quick question, going back to two questions, going back to IRC. One, can you comment on Java IRC and going back to them being able to find your ISP, your IP address? If you're on a dial-up, obviously every time you dial up, and I think even for DSL, your IP address changes. So they're not going to really be able to get your IP address, but could they get your MAC address, which is, of course, based on your card?
They can't get it because you hear a lot about MAC addresses. What happens is you know, a MAC address is the actual physical address of your card. And so what happens is, you know, I don't want to get too deep into TCP/IP, but what happens is if you want to send something out and it's not on you, if it's on your subnet, you'll send it straight to the MAC address. If it's not on your subnet, you'll send it to the MAC address of your gateway, because the actual Ethernet segments itself doesn't understand IP addresses. That's all done, you know, in the IP stack. So it encodes it with the MAC address of your gateway. The gateway then sends the next packet to its gateway using its MAC address. So your MAC address gets scrubbed. The second you've been routed, your MAC address is changed. And therefore, unless something on your machine catalogs your MAC address and sends it as part of the data that it sends, it'll be scrubbed. You can't track by MAC address. And the thing, you're right, you know, with a lot of dial-ups, and even when you're talking about broadband, you know, you got DHCP, your address changes. But my point is, while you're on IRC, your address isn't going to change. It's not going to change until either you have a DHCP renew and don't get renewed your license, or the next time you dial up. So while you're on IRC, you're vulnerable to people who are on IRC because they can easily get your IP address and attack you right now. Yeah, for that session, for right in the middle of what you're doing. What can you do? First thing, lock it down. Like I said, all the software that comes right out of the box, it's going to have everything turned on, all the whiz bang features that you never need. So you got to start locking some of this stuff down. Disable file sharing. If you're on like Linux, Unix operating system, make sure you don't have FTPD running, and make sure you know it's not running through INET. Also want to make sure Telnet's not running. If you're on Microsoft Windows 98 under the network neighborhood, you can right-click on the network neighborhood, go to, I think for 98, it's right-click on network neighborhood, go to properties, and make sure file and print sharing is turned off. For Windows 2000 and XP, the easiest way to accomplish this goal, go into your services and turn your server service off. Disable it for startup. Because unless you're on a network and you need to share a lot of files, if you're just one machine on that, you don't want that on. You don't want the server service on, because so many things rely on the server service to be able, but everything that relies on it is all to serve content. And if you don't want to serve content, you don't need the server service turned on. And that one place will actually clean up a lot of mess that's left over on your machine, like the default admin shares to all of your drives, the fact that the default permissions for NTFS are everyone full control. So that's like, let's see, out of the box, I've got file shares that are sharing out my hard drives to everybody, and everybody's allowed to connect, so woo. So yeah, that server service, kill it. Require a logon. That's the other thing. In Windows 2000, and it's going to be like this in XP2, when you're doing the install, they ask you if you want to have an account that's always logged in or whether you want to require a login. Always require a login. What's going to happen if you don't is they're going to leave one account that's always logged in every time the machine is on, and it's going to be an administrator account, because they want you to be able to do everything that you want to do on your machine. If you don't want the hassle of logging in, they want that account to have ultimate power over your machine, and it will. And so you'll be logged in constantly as long as your machine is up and running as the administrator, and you don't want that. Bad things can happen. Don't surf from the administrator root account. A lot of these things, actually most things that you're going to run into that are problems, require some intervention on your part. Either you have to click on a link, you have to go to a website, you have to download a file, you have to accept an incoming file transfer, you know, something like that. But the user will require you to do something. And as such, a lot of these things are going to run, if you execute them, they're going to try to run under the rights and privileges of the account that you're currently logged on. Now, for most uses of your computer, a user account is sufficient. Being in the users group is sufficient. For some things like installing new fonts, installing some software that uses network stuff, you need to be a power user. You should never be logged on and doing anything productive, anything to your machine other than installing new hardware or installing something you absolutely have to install as administrator root, you should never be logged on as root. When you're surfing the web, when you're checking your email, never be logged on as the administrator or in the administrator's group. You're just asking for trouble. What happens is you can download a say you download something like a StyleRot or something, a distributed denial of service zombie. It may have to, since Windows out of the box, well, this will change in XP, but up until 2000, didn't allow for spoofing source addresses very easily. You could do it, but it required installing a driver, a raw packet driver, in order to do it. Only the administrator can install new services, and only the administrator can install new drivers. So what would happen is if you were a user and you clicked on this thing that looked all innocent, all of a sudden you'd get a box that popped up that says, do you want to install this system driver? Well, wait a minute. How is me playing this MP3 need to install a system driver? No. So at least you get a chance. It'll prompt you or it'll come up and say, you don't have permissions to install this driver. And you go, ooh, that was a bad thing. But if you're an administrator account, what happened? You wouldn't. Your machine might have slowed down for a second, but you might not have seen anything. Had no idea. So don't do anything from the administrator account other than what you absolutely have to. Check frequently for security patches. Another thing, especially with commercial software, is the big important thing is time to market. So what happens is if the development cycle takes a little bit too long to develop it and you've already announced that your product has to come, they usually take that time out of the testing. And they may not test everything fully, and they may say, well, okay, it works reasonably well now, and then if anybody finds any holes, we'll patch them. And that's what happens. This software gets released. You get security experts that start picking it apart, laughing at it. They call up Microsoft and say, look, we just found this big thing, you numbskull. Why don't you close this hole? We'll give you 30 days before we tell everybody in the world. So Microsoft goes, oh, okay. And they, you know, make their little security patch. And then you get to announce that you found this hole. And Microsoft announces exactly the same time that they've got a patch for it. So, and this happens over and over and over again. And those patches start stacking up. So check, and not just for your operating system, but for all your software. Check frequently for security patches and see if there's any updates that you need to apply. Because if there are bugs that are found that are known, there probably has been a tool that has been written to exploit it. And if you don't get patched, you're still vulnerable.
Are there any centralized registries that we can trust that we can download
a whole host of patches at one time and just say, okay, I trust this site to patch whatever is on my machine that needs patching, download it, and it'll check my machine, it'll patch them?
I would always go to the vendors looking for the patches. Like for Microsoft, go to update. Now, does that guarantee that you're not going to get put in trouble there and install backdoor? No, it doesn't, because it's possible to do things like hijack DNS and you type in Windows update .microsoft.com, you hit enter and you go to my box instead of Microsoft. It's possible, but it's really difficult. Again, we're talking about raising the bar. Those kind of attacks where you subvert whole domains and you do things like that are a lot harder than running simple tools, and they require a much higher level of sophistication to pull off. So generally speaking, you go to like the Windows update site, you know, it'll probably be all right. If you're on HTTPS, especially, check the certificate. That might help. You know, I mean, if there's a certificate available, look and make sure that it hasn't been revoked. But for the most part, you know, you gotta trust that they've got enough security to control and make sure that they're not getting feeding out Trojans instead of patches.
John.
Sure.
Gibson Research, GRC.com.
Yeah, for links to them, yeah, Gibson's a good place. I'm trying not to push anybody's security sites, because the one thing that you run a risk of is if you don't remember who I was talking about here today, I'm worried that people are going to go and type into a search engine and go to a page that is not respectable. And since you don't know the difference between is Gibson a good guy or a bad guy, you know, since you don't know, I would always be wary. Gibson Research is a good place to go, but I would always be wary of getting any kind of product update or patches from anywhere other than the vendor. And if it's legitimate, you'll usually see links that will go to the vendor site to pull the stuff off instead of actually being local copy.
Another question. Going backtracking slightly, it seems that basically swiping and creating invalid, although really, really credible-looking certificates seems to be the next bar that's being raised. You may remember the situation where Microsoft gave out a certification which turned out to somehow not really be theirs.
Marvelous example of social engineering. No hacking involved. They call up. They said, "Hi, we're Microsoft. We need a new certificate." VeriSign issued the certificate. Yeah, that's what I say. Somebody called up.
VeriSign is the trusted organization for all certificates. So when they made the mistake, that was a lot more dangerous. In fact, it's actually a vulnerability we had warned them about 2 years ago.
It gets back to that cat and mouse game, though, that I'm talking about. You'd think that okay, because when you look at the actual attack of what they did, they called up Microsoft. They said they needed to be issued a new certificate, and the VeriSign people, you know, through charm and guile, they got the VeriSign people to issue them a certificate as Microsoft without checking, which was a very stupid thing. But social engineering is responsible for a lot of stuff. I mean, Mitnick, that was his bag, you know. I mean, he was the man when it came to social engineering, getting passwords off of people, calling up and saying, "Hey, I'm your help desk. I need to know what your password is so I can change," you know, that kind of stuff. But again, we're talking about raising the bar, because phone calls, at least somewhat, are traceable. You know, you got to expect that person might have been new. You got to expect that there would be people there that would be looking for that kind of thing, you know, that would worry about it. So the risk becomes high enough that people don't bother. You know, the bar is way too high. That's too scary of a concept. And also, a lot of people don't understand exactly how these things can be subverted. I mean, you can say, okay, social engineering, but what does that really entail, and how do I pull it off without getting caught? And so the motivation factor is really big in there. I'm going to need to probably stop taking questions for a minute, because I got a lot of slides I got to fly through. And then so if you can just save them and hold them off till the end, then I'll try to get everything. Check services, daemons, and startup. One thing as an attacker that they run into is they may get you to launch an executable and put it up into your memory, but the second you reboot that box, all their work is done. Unless they can con you into doing that again, it's over with. So what they're going to do is they want to make sure that this tool, whatever it is, whether it be a distributed denial of service zombie, or you know, something like VNC or Sub7, a backdoor to get back in, they want to make sure that this is persistent across reboots. So what they're going to do is they're going to try to get the system to start their tool up automatically when you do it. Places that you need to look for. In the start menu, there's a little thing called startup. Anything in there will be run every time the machine loads up. Also in the registry, and again, I'm. Let me give you this disclaimer. If you're afraid of the registry and you're worried about messing your machine up, don't mess with it. You know, because you have the potential to hose your installation and to get in trouble. So that's why I'm not putting the actual key here that you need to mess with, but just for those of your current, the H key local machine or H key current users, if you drill down under software, Windows, Microsoft Windows, there's a key called run, and anything that's specified in those run keys, either under H key local machine, H key current user, or H key users, will get run every single time. Now, if you want to go check for that, go to Microsoft site or go to... Man, you could just do a thing on startup registry and do a search on it, and you'll get plenty of information. It's well documented. Those keys are well documented on the web, so you can go see that, and they're going to warn you, you know, back up your registry and everything like that. Services, they might install phantom services. You should always, and here's the other thing too. I don't want to recommend that you go into your services and go willy-nilly turning things off. Because, again, you might cause yourself some serious problems for which you may or may not have the ability to recover from. But look for things that look out of the ordinary, that look just too odd or look like something strange. And if you don't necessarily know what it is and you want to play, one thing you can do is first of all, you can stop it and see if anything breaks. If nothing breaks, then you can change startup from automatic to manual. And what that allow is that allows you a way out, because that way if your system tries to start up and that's not automatic but something that depends on that service has to use that service, it'll prompt you. It'll say, "Can I start this up?" You know, like that'll happen for service too, like Windows messaging. Like if you had left Windows messaging on and you put service to manual, Windows messaging will try to come up and it'll say, "Windows messaging can't come up unless the service is turned on. Want to turn it on?" Yes, no. So you can go through that kind of stuff. But generally speaking, if you reboot it a couple times and it's been a couple weeks and you've been messing with it and it's been set to manual and it's never bugged you, you might be able to turn it off. But you can find out more detailed information on what every single service does, or at least all the ones that are installed by default, by going out, checking the web, checking Microsoft site. There's actually some knowledge base articles out there that will tell you exactly what every service does, what its dependencies are, and what you need it for, and whether you should get rid of it or not. Same thing on Unix. You know, if you don't need FTP and Telnet running, turn them off. You know, if you don't need the network time protocol running, turn it off. You know, I mean, any daemon that you open and you have running on Unix, and every service that you network aware service that you have running on Microsoft is a potential way in. You know, it's a potential door that somebody could use. Use strong passwords. And this goes true for logging in or when you use passwords for anything that you really care about out on the internet. You should always use strong passwords. And what I mean by strong passwords, if you can find it in a dictionary, it's not a strong password. Absolutely, bar none, not a strong password. What actually makes good and so the ideal password would be a combination of uppercase and lowercase letters, numbers, and symbols. Now, everybody goes, yeah, but that's a big pain, and that's a lot really hard to remember. So good practical or strong practical passwords are things like misspell words. Misspell words, that works well because then simple dictionary attacks don't work because that spelling is not in the dictionary. Replace certain letters with numbers. You know, maybe use a 1 instead of an L or a 3 instead of an E. You know, those kind of things. Or use the at symbol instead of an A. Those kind of things. If you misspell them and use letters and punctuation, that kind of stuff, it makes a much stronger password, much harder to break. Set your zones. And this is what we're talking about earlier about the Outlook auto running things and when you surf to sites, you know, being able to get hit. By default, two things happen. One is the internet zone for which all of your security is defined when you start up. We're talking Outlook, we're talking Internet Explorer. Has everything pretty much wide open because they don't want you to ever go to a web page and not be able to see content because they want to talk the people into running IIS and using all of the content that they have that Microsoft has available for them to program in. You know, as a matter of fact, this gets even scarier. I just read something not too long ago. I was talking about in Internet Explorer 5.5 Service Pack 2 and Internet Explorer 6. They've pulled all support for plugins, which means there'll be no more Java plugins. And what they're trying to do is get everybody, even if you want to use JavaScript, they want you to use an ActiveX control in order to implement that. And ActiveX is dangerous. It gives a lot of power to remote people over your machine and can cause a lot of problems. So the first thing you want to do is go in and to get to this, if you open up Explorer, under Tools, Options, there's a security tab, and you'll see the little zones. You know, it says Trusted Sites and Internet and Intranet, I think, Intranet and Restricted Zones. Go into the Internet settings because that's the one that you're going to be using by default. It's set to medium. Go in there and look at some of those settings. In there you'll see ActiveX. And for signed ActiveX controls, it's enabled by default, meaning you go to a page, if it has that ActiveX control and there's a signature on it, it'll automatically run it. It won't ask you. Ideally, you know, if you wanted to be completely, you know, if you wanted to harden yourself down, you turn off all ActiveX and you turn off all scripting. But the reality is that's going to break a lot of web pages that you might want to use. The alternative is to set all that stuff to prompt. You know, you might want to disable ActiveX and then turn active scripting, which is the very bottom of that little menu. Active scripting to prompt, because active scripting controls the scripting, global scripting of JavaScripts and ActiveX. So if you turn active scripting to prompt, it means almost guaranteed every web page that you go to, you'll get a little box that pops up and says, there are scripts on this page. Do you want to run them? Yes or no? And you may get multiple boxes. Me, that's the world in which I live. I have everything set to it. So I always go to a page and I'm like, no, 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 no. Page comes up. Go to another page. No, no, no. Page comes up. Might be a pain, but it'll definitely prevent you from a lot of headaches. You can turn it off, but like I said, some pages won't work. If you turn it off completely, understand that if you can't get to a page and it says some content can't be displayed, or you just have repeated problems, you might just get just a blue background and nothing on it, then you might need to go in and adjust your settings, at least make it to prompt. ActiveX will come up slightly different. It'll tell you that it's ActiveX when it comes up. So if you have both of them set to prompt, you can see what's regular scripting, which is going to be like JavaScripting, or what's ActiveX. So watch that. Stored cookies. This is not so much a people compromising your machine issue as a privacy issue, and these things are often abused, so I just thought I would throw that in here while I'm in there. Per-session cookies are good enough for just about everything. The only thing that they're not good for is if you want it to remember your login credentials. Well, if you really want them to remember your login credentials, then that's cool. Turn it to allow them to store it on there. But prompt could be nice too, because a lot of places, those banner ads that you see that pop up all over the place, when you go to a site, those banner ads will put cookies on your hard drive. Then every time you go to a site that has a banner ad owned by that company, it checks and sees that there's a cookie from it, and it marks you down on a list of every single site you're going to and everything you're doing, and then they start tracking you for purposes of gathering information, marketing products to you, controlling what banner ads you see, that kind of stuff. So, you know, something to warrant a little investigation there. Outlook. Open up Outlook, and you go to Tools, and you go to the options. There's going to be the Security tab, and it's going to look exactly the same as the Security tab you see under Internet Explorer. By default, Outlook is using the Internet settings. You want to change that to use the Restricted Zone settings. Now, once you change it to use the restricted zones, you're still not safe, because for some reason that I cannot possibly understand, Microsoft decided that even if you were in a restricted zone, scripting is okay. And it's still turned on even in the restricted zones. I mean, it cuts down the level what you can do, but they still leave ActiveX and they still leave active scripting on. Go in there, turn it off. Turn it off. Turn off active scripting, because if somebody sends you an email attachment that wants to play little games and music and stuff like that, you know, there might be a legitimate use. But in the reality, nobody ever uses scripts or very rarely use scripts for any legitimate purposes in an email. And there's no need for your email to go ahead and render and run scripts, because that's how you get caught. On some versions of Outlook, it's you don't even have to open the attachments. If your preview pane touches the email, the script will get executed, flat out. If they make it an HTML email and they embed it, the second your preview pane touches it, not even you opening the email, the second your preview pane touches it, it'll launch. Turn off scripting for your restricted zones. Set Outlook to use the restricted zones. IRC, DCC, same thing. When we were talking about instant messengers earlier, I said normally when you're sending messages, you're sending them to a server. Server is broadcasting them back out, so you're seeing what all is going on in the channels. IRC works the same way. You send what you type, gets sent to the server. The server then broadcasts it out to everybody as a line of text so they can all see it. DCC works differently. It works direct connection between your machine and somebody else's machine. So, again, there's the potential there for damage. Chat, you're still vulnerable. It's possible for overflows, but not as dangerous as file transfers, which they can do it. And there are some clients out there that have, like, automatic receive, stuff like that. Oh, no, bad. Personally, I recommend you turning it completely off. And if there's a special circumstance you want to share a file with somebody, turn it back on. But at the least, go through your settings and make sure that there's no auto receive for anybody. You don't ever want auto receive. You always want to be prompted, because it always gives you a choice. I mean, yeah, this little box pops up, but it takes less than a second to click a button. But without it, you never know. You know, people could be running anything. So prompt is usually a good way to go. Instant messenger, same thing. File transfers, a lot of them automatic. You know, automatic from people in your contact list or buddy list, and automatic accept messages from everybody. Well, you want to go in there and turn some of that stuff off. Personally, I recommend, if it's possible, to restrict who can talk to you based on your contact or buddy list or whatever the instant messenger client you choose to use has. I would go for that setting. I would restrict it to people that you know. I would definitely restrict file transfers, and I would make it prompt you. So don't allow for any auto file transfers. It can get you in trouble. Beware of attachments. We kind of covered a lot of this stuff earlier. If you get an attachment from an address you don't know, don't open it.
Are you going to comment on Navigator as well? Can you comment on IE? Some of the things that say, it says for IE, but now
it's... Some of them do, but it's older. Like the Java, the Java virtual machine and that they have, I mean, Sun... Well, the Java Virtual Machine that comes in Netscape, and the design of Netscape is more to use Java. And as I said before, Java is not as bad as ActiveX. I haven't used 6.0, so I don't personally know where the settings are to go in and try to find out what kind of ActiveX support they have. But I definitely encourage you. I'm sorry I can't answer the question real well, but I don't use Netscape on a regular basis. But I encourage you to always go through all of the settings every time you get a new product. A, just to see what's in there, because you may learn of new features that you never knew about. But B, look for things that look like stuff that you don't necessarily want. Follow the kind of guidelines that I'm giving you here, and just think about it. You know, look at your software. Hopefully you'll walk away from here looking at your software in a little differently.
IE?
Well, people are less likely to write some automatic stuff for it, but keep in mind, too, using an old version of Navigator, you have more bugs. So it's one of those things where, yeah, people are going to write viruses to Outlook. They're going to write malicious web pages to Internet Explorer, because that's what most people use. So by that right, you know, security through obscurity. Go with Navigator or Opera or something like that. It's always a trade-off, because again, the older stuff, because it's not, now that AOL owns Netscape, they're not as speedy with the updates, and they don't give as much time and development resources to Netscape as Netscape had when it was in its own company. So again, it comes down to, I don't know. But you're right, for most of the stuff is going to be designed for IE users, so having Netscape might pull you out of the fire a little bit. Obviously, never open attachments from addresses you don't know. Get confirmation from people you do know, because emails can be spoofed. Emails can be spoofed, IRC nicknames. Even if you're doing something like Dalnet, which has a register, that register can be hacked. I can steal your screen name. You think that somebody thinks that they're talking to your window. They're talking to me. You know, and I'll, oh, hi, how's it going? Keep the chat generic. You know, this may be a friend that you've had online for a long time, goes to send you a thing. Not talking to who you think you are. Email's really bad about that, spoofing emails. There's a lot of open email relays out on the net, and unfortunately, a lot of companies and especially universities don't have the time and the resources, or don't really care enough to go in and lock down their email server. So email is incredibly easy to spoof. Instant messaging too. There's a lot of programs out there that'll actually spoof instant messages from anyone to anyone. So the same kind of thing you have to worry about. Avoid or be careful in bad neighborhoods. Porn sites, whereas sites, and IRC. Good rule of thumb here is, you know, we talked earlier about a porn storm. Well, it's called a porn storm because generally you only see it if you go to porn sites. What's going to happen is people like to exploit anything that they can. How should I put this? All right, it's like this. If you're looking for whereas, you're looking for stuff that is by definition illegal. If you're looking for porn, you're looking at stuff that may or may not be illegal, but is maybe not something you want everybody to know, kind of questionable. So if I wanted to host malicious content, first of all, I know both whereas and porn sites are going to get tons of traffic, because everybody goes out to them. But I feel better about putting something malicious up there, because I'm more likely to get them to not care and to click on some links thinking that they're going to get something and not so much worry about it. And I know that if I do start a porn storm or I do backdoor them and they catch me, they're less likely to tell somebody about it. You're going to call up the cops. Hey, man, I was downloading the newest cracked version of Windows XP off of this site, and believe it or not, I got a virus. You know, I mean, because people are going to go, oh, well, I guess I shouldn't have been to that site, and not going to report them. So their risk factor becomes low because they don't think that you'll report them even if you notice what's going on. So you see a whole lot of activity on porn sites and aware sites. And then IRC, it comes back to what I was talking about earlier, that since you have somewhat of a relationship with some of these people online, it increases their motivation and thus makes you a target where you might not have been otherwise. Get some defenses. All of the stuff that I've mentioned up till now has the potential to keep you secure. I mean, if you keep your machine locked down and you don't allow anything, you know, to come on without your permission, you're pretty much safe. You're pretty much safe against everything, even what we call zero-day exploits, which are something that's brand new, never been seen before, just being put out, because a lot of this stuff will go towards breaking that. But certainly defenses don't help, because if you side a little bit more on the usability than the security on anything, these might catch some of that overlap, or they might catch you if something new comes out in a way that you hadn't thought of before. Firewalls are good to prevent people from attaching to your machine in ways that you may not want them to. There's some limitations there, because if it looks like legitimate traffic to the firewall, the firewall is going to let it through, even though it may not be legitimate traffic. So it's, again, this, like I talked about earlier, it's not a silver bullet. Firewall won't protect you. It can do some nice things. Like, I recommend Zone Alarm, A, because it's free. If you go to their page, you see all these advertisements, Zone Alarm Pro 1.0, blah, 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 blah. And you dig all the way down to the bottom, and a little bitty print, it says free download. And you click there, and you get the free version, which is about the same as the version you have to buy. So at least the cost is down on Zone Alarm, and it has a nice feature in that it has a stop button. So if you're not sitting at your machine, you hit the stop button. You walk away. Nothing is going in and out of your machine until you come back and hit start. That's pretty nice. It's nice to be able to drop that hard wall down. And when it's not out of the box, you know, it's doing things like blocking your NetBIOS ports where people will come in on file shares. And you'll at least get the amusement of getting to see people scanning to see if you have NetBus installed or, you know, whatever the favorite Trojan of the day. So it provides some protection. eSafe, I put on there, they do more of a content filter, and some of that stuff that you were talking about that checks scripts as scripts are running, ActiveX controls, things like that, and it's set to block some of those and provide you kind of a sandbox for stuff that isn't normally sandboxed. Antivirus, Norton Antivirus, and McAfee Virus Scan, get it, it's good. You know, get some antivirus, whatever it is, because it's always better than not having it. And not only get it, but update it frequently. You know, at least at a minimum, check once a month. But, I mean, once every couple weeks is nice. Or if you hear on the news that there's a virus, go check. Because by the time it's gotten in the news, that means infection's gotten so widespread that it has become newsworthy, and the chances of you getting hit are pretty high. So always keep your antivirus stuff up to date. IDS Firewall, I didn't include these in a firewall because these are actually a little step beyond. Black Ice Defender, Norton Internet Security, things of that nature. In addition to providing firewall-like functionality, they let you know when you're getting attacked. Is that useful for you? Maybe. I mean, if you're going to be somebody that like I said, if you're somebody who uses IRC, this is a good thing to have, because not only does it offer you some protection in a bad neighborhood, but also, you know, it's nice to go, hey, stop it. I can see you're doing it, because that's something else that will get people to stop. If you know, if they try to attack you and they're unsuccessful, they may keep trying to attack. If they try to attack you, they're unsuccessful, and you noticed it, and you pointed it out that they're doing it, you know, either you'll raise the bar, and they'll go, oh, I'll really get them, or they'll go, oops, and kind of back off, and they'll be like, ha, 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 and play it off, because they don't want to get in trouble, you know? I mean, even if we're talking about, like, a 14-year-old kid who doesn't necessarily have to worry about too much legal repercussions for doing some of this stuff, because they're a minor, their parents might take their machine away, you know, they can still be notified. So, you know, a lot of times if people think they're going to get caught, they won't do it. You know, it ceases to become worth their time and energy. In either one of these products, and there's other products out there, you know, like I said, it's a firewall plus. It'll tell you when you get it attacked. Do you need this? Not necessarily. I mean, you're getting some advantage over having just a firewall, but a lot of what it is just passive monitoring. I mean, it'll block this stuff, but, I mean, if you're following good practices, it'll be blocked anyway, but at least you'll know about it, so it's kind of cool. You go, hey, somebody tried to hack me, and I didn't get hacked. So that's kind of fun, too. Right. Yes, that's correct, because whereas a firewall controls access based on ports, really, you know, I mean, source and destination of port, or it might control it on addresses. You know, you can have some addresses that are okay to do it, but it pretty much is just looking for where they're where they're connecting in your stack. It doesn't look at what's going on the wire. These things, the IDSs are like the antivirus stuff in that they're signature based. They're looking for telltale signs of specific tools being used, And they'll nab it. If they flag something that is going on, they go, hey, something's not right here because I know that they're using this tool, or I know they're trying to do this to you or that to you. So it gives you additional coverage in that, in addition to just blocking certain ports, it'll catch some traffic on legitimate ports that a firewall would otherwise let through. So, I mean, they're good things to have. And they're generally, you know, $20 to $50. I mean, do you want to spend the money on it or not? I mean, it's up to you.
Wait. Oh, is that the only disadvantage of the Black Ops Defender or Norton Internet Security, that they cost more? Otherwise, they do everything that the zone alarm would do?
That's really the only disadvantage, because the firewall technology in both of those products is pretty good. And like I said, you've piggybacked IDS on there, so you're getting some additional protection.
And are they relatively easy to use?
They really are. Both Black Ice and Black Ice, which is now owned by ISS, and Norton, which is owned by Symantec, have both put a lot of time and energy trying to make it as easy to use outside of the box.
And
a lot of good default rules blocking some of the most common stuff. Like I said, TCP 135 through 139, which is the zone in which NetBIOS works, file shares, you know, the Windows file sharing stuff, are automatically blocked by pretty much any of these. You know, you install them, so at least, boom, there's some protection out of the box. And you can also customize rules.
And if you were picking between those two?
I really wouldn't make a recommendation. Most of the stuff that I do, I generally work on a much bigger scale. You know, I work on developing enterprise level intrusion detection systems, and so I don't personally run either one of these at home. I have, you know, I use like a IP change, and I've got Snort, and I use Checkpoint Firewall and Real Secure. I mean, I use the big boy stuff, so I don't have enough hands on experience to say specifically which one to get, but they both have very good reputations, and they're both in pretty wide use.
And is there if you were getting, say, Black Ice Defender, is there just a basic one, or are there different levels? You know, Black Ice Defender Pro, Ultimate, or something like that.
I don't think so, because Defender costs. There is no free version of Black Ice Defender. There's cracked versions of Black Ice Defender, but there are no free versions of Black Ice Defender, and as such, I don't think there is a distinguishing point. For Norton, they've got the same technology. They have the Norton Personal Firewall, which is just the firewall part of it, and then they have the Norton Internet Security, which is their firewall with IDS on top of it. So you can choose to buy just the firewall, or you can get the firewall with IDS, but it's the exact same firewall in both products. For Zone Alarm, they basically gave away a really, really good, cool product for free and gave it away for a long time, and then said, wait a minute, how are we going to make money off of this? Hold on. You know, if we keep giving this out for free, we're going to have to do it. So they rolled in some additional features and stuff. As far as value add you get from going to Zone Alarm Pro, I don't know. But I've recommended, and I know a lot of people who use Zone Alarm at home and are very happy with it. It's a pretty good thing. I mean, there's always ways to exploit it. Gibson, I believe, pointed out some ways to get around it, where you can. One nice thing that Zone Alarm does is it controls your outbound stuff too, but based on application. Like Internet Explorer, you want to run Explorer, it'll say, okay, Explorer is allowed to go out, and it's allowed to go out to port 80 because I know what this application is and I know what it does. There were some ways around it where somebody said, yeah, but if I make a Trojan and I call it iExplorer, you're not going to know the difference between the real Internet Explorer and my thing, as long as it's going out on 80. But I think Zone Alarm was the only one who didn't do that, because it actually did checksums. I mean, it starts to get – when you start doing product comparisons, that's always going to change. I mean, as new people come out with new versions, some are going to be better, some aren't. And there's a lot of sites out there that will rank them for you and give you good comparisons, like good bullet points on what's good and what's bad, independent stuff. And I recommend that you check them out, especially if you're considering buying products. Zone Alarm, like I said, I can – freely and easily recommend that, because it's a free product, and it, you know, what does it cost you other than installing it? So I highly recommend that. Anything else, before you spend money, you know, go out, do your research, just like you would about doing anything else, like when you would go buy a car or buy anything else, you know, kick the tires, maybe see if there's a demo version, and probably be all right. Scan yourself. There's some cool stuff. I had some more links, and unfortunately, I had problems with the earlier PowerPoint presentation. Yes? Oh, I'm sorry.
For someone with a small home network, do you think it's worth having a dedicated firewall or just putting stuff on the local machines?
For somebody with a small home network, well, first of all, you have to have, if you're doing connection sharing, you've got to have connection sharing possible in some way. If you get something like a D-Link, you know, internet router firewalls, you know, they got 4-port hubs and then 1 port that plugs into your cable modem or your DSL modem, whatever. Those things have firewalls built in. A lot of people, you know, and by default, they usually have some things turned off. Those things are really good. I recommend them because if nothing else, they do a NAT. They do a hide NAT. And NAS, where it's called network address translation, all of the stuff in your network has IP addresses that are not routable or not real. So nobody can ever address your machine directly. The best they can do is address your router box, which then in turn decides who do they really want to talk to back here. So those things are very cool too. And if you've got one of those, you know, you can always do the thing. Okay. Yeah, sure.
Are there any other products to block pop-up windows and the like? I know Inoculated used to be a free product of that, but now they're charging.
Yeah, there's a pop-up killer, and there's some other ones. But like I said, if you know you're going to a bad neighborhood, like I said before, like normally, you know, you don't mess with all that prompting and all that crud because you don't want to you know, you don't want the hassle. If you're going to go porn surfing, take some time. Go into your internet thing and turn active scripting at least to prompt, because if you keep saying no, you can't do it. The only way that works is, the porn storm, is you go to a page. The page says automatically open these pages, and then those pages say automatically open these pages, but they're all scripts. So you can say no and then close the ones. You know, once it starts, if you said yes and once it starts, you can say no to all of them and then close them all down, and that's it. No more storm.
Yeah, I've been finding that kind of thing on other sites other than porns, just with advertising, where they want to link to another advertisement, and that one's linking to another advertisement.
X10? Yeah, the sad part is that that's actually been, read a couple about that, talking, that's actually been a good revenue stream for them, those pop-ups, is knowing those as they are, making them money, so I'd expect to see more of that in the future. Yeah, there are some products I can't think of a lot of them off, right now, but, you know, do a search on the net. They're going to be there. I just wanted to tell you two more things, and then I got to go because I'm running long. First is there's a free port scanner. Well, actually, there's several, but here's a good free port scanner that's up on the net, DSL Reports. Now, unfortunately, they're now charging for a lot of their content, so they took the link off their main page to get to this free scanning utility. But if you put that /scan in there, it'll do a port scanner. You run scan me, it'll scan you, it'll tell you everything that it has open, and then it'll tell you what to do about it, how to fix it. Also, we got an online scanner.iss.net. It uses an ActiveX control, so don't worry about that. It does it, checks not for your ports, but it actually checks through Explorer, it checks through Outlook, and it looks through a lot of your settings and sees where you might have problems, and then it'll tell you exactly how to go and where, step by step, to go turn all that stuff off. So that can be a good resource for you as well. So I guess I'm done here. Good luck and safe hunting. I'll be sitting out here after the thing if you want to talk to me anymore.